This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comics show, and I'm one of the hosts, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as he is always, is Dan Gunther.
Well, I'm the other host, Dan Gunther. How's it going, Matthew?
It's going well. Oh wait, that's not your brother, Dan Gunther? And your other brother, Dan?
No 80s, 90s sitcoms flashbacks for me here. Just me, myself, and I.
Oh, okay. I must have just seen double there for a second. So only one Dan Gunther with us tonight, because there is only one. And well, Dan, we got some exciting news, actually, out of Comic-Con about some of the things they're going to be doing at IDW to celebrate, well, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, as well as the 50th issue celebration.
Yeah, Matthew, this is pretty cool. Did you know that, this October we're getting the release of the 50th issue of the Star Trek ongoing series. Did you know that makes it one of the longest running Star Trek comic series by any publisher?
I didn't know that until I read this, and that's crazy. That's
right?
Awesome.
Yeah. That's really crazy to think about. You think about how many, you know, Star Trek series there have been. You know, DC and, you know, Marvel had the title for a while. It's really cool to see this series kind of blazing its own path and really becoming a force in the Star Trek comic canon, really.
Well, and, you know, I think personally that it's just, one, it's been pretty good comic, and two, we only get a new JJ movie every few years, and this is the only place to kind of see those characters progress and kind of grow and change a little bit before we get that new film to come out. And so I think that might be one of the reasons that it's continued on so long, is we've really just had so many years between each of the movies. They keep putting out the comics so that fans have something from the JJ verse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's definitely very true. Well, this 50th issue is going to kick off an epic three-part adventure that will introduce the classic Mirror Mirror storyline into the new film-based universe. And what's really cool is this issue will also boast additional bonus content, including behind-the-scenes looks at the entire 50-issue run, along with hints about where the series is going from here. And also, it's going to have a really cool wraparound cover by series artist Tony Shasteen. So definitely looking forward to checking that one out.
That is pretty exciting. I think that this might be a comic that I actually go to the comic book store and pick up a copy of to have with all this bonus material that's going to be in there. I think this is really cool. I'm excited to see them, you know, making a big deal out of something with Star Trek. I mean, I just feel like as we're moving towards the 50th anniversary, I mean, I know a new film is coming out, Star Trek Beyond. That's really exciting. We had the big announcement of you could be on Star Trek if you donate money, the new film. That's great. But nothing else I feel like has really been made a big deal. We're not going to get Blu-ray releases or anything awesome like that. So this is one of the first things I've seen, like, hey, let's celebrate something Star Trek.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's an event. You know, the 50th anniversary of Star Trek is only going to happen once. And, yeah, the more cool stuff that we get, the more cool releases and celebrations of this milestone, I think the better. So, you know, it's good to see IDW kind of pulling out the stops and giving us something really interesting here.
Well, and the next thing too that they announce is that in December they're going to add a completely new dynamic to the JJ-verse comics, and they're going to be doing Star Trek Starfleet Academy, which is following all of these characters, which, you know, we saw a little bit of that in 09, which was so much fun, I think, the Academy kids. But I'm really interested to kind of see how these kids grew up, and they said this idea of the past and the present collide when a mystery bridges the two timelines, you know. So that's going to be interesting as well, how all of this just kind of plays out. Getting to know the background of these characters here, we've had a little bit of that in the comic series. They did that for each of them kind of at the beginning, kind of telling some backstory. But seeing more in depth through an entire comic devoted to their Starfleet Academy years, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. And also the added element of having the, you know, all new cast of current day Starfleet cadets as well, gives some interesting dynamics to bring into play here. Looking at the cover, there's a, you know, couple, like an alien cadet that we've never seen before, a female Vulcan, a couple humans. You know, I'm really interested in seeing, you know, how these new characters interact and work together. I'm kind of thinking of Marvel's Starfleet Academy series, where they introduced a whole bunch of new characters alongside Nog, and, you know, that was great, you know. So these original characters can sometimes be really interesting. So I'm eager to see where this goes.
Well, it's nice to see some fun things coming for us in the comics to be looking at. I mean, we both really enjoyed so far the issue that we had, the Green Lantern Star Trek crossover, and we've been enjoying for the most part the new Visions, but I love seeing that this comic series that is introduced is another comic. You know, it's not a photo comic like John Byrne's been doing, and I like the subject matter. I think it's going to be really interesting. So we'll definitely put a link there in the show notes to this so you can take a look at some of those things. And I'm super excited, Dan, because we get to jump in now and talk to David R. George III about Sacraments of Fire.
Excellent.
Dan, I think that you will agree with me that probably the biggest joy of doing Literary Treks is the fact that we get to have so many of the authors on the show. And I've got to say thank you to them, first of all, just because they are so generous with their time to come on and talk about these books. And these guys are fans just like us, and they love talking Star Trek. So it's so great to be able to welcome David R. George III back to the show. Hey, David.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Hi, David. Always a thrill to talk to the authors, and great to have you on.
I had fun talking to the authors, too. It was at Comic-Con this past weekend and got to visit with some of my old cronies, so that was a lot of fun.
That's nice. Before we get into it, you know, just a huge geek of everything, was there anything specific that stood out for you at Comic-Con that you really enjoyed, you know, announcement-wise, or any panels you got to see or anything like that?
Comic-Con is sort of, I've taken a kind of a kamikaze approach to Comic-Con in the last couple of years. I don't know how many times I've been, 6, 7, 8 times. I'm not sure how many now, but the last few years I've found that the least painful way to go, because it can be a great deal of effort. In I live in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
Comic-Con is down in San Diego. Driving there, working your way around in a car, finding parking, the expense of it, staying in hotels, it can be an enormous undertaking. And so the last couple of years, I get on a train early on Saturday morning, take the train down to San Diego, get off, walk to the convention, spend the day there, and then pop home that night back on the train. So
that's nice.
The one thing about that is, you know, I don't get to experience everything, all the panels and all. I go to mostly to see friends who are a lot of the Star Trek writers. This year I had a book come out, which is one of the reasons we're here, just a couple of weeks ago. So I was doing a book signing. So there was nothing in particular. It was just good for me to be able to see Kevin Dillmore and Andy Mangles and Marco Palmieri and people like that and get to visit with them. That's mostly what Comic-Con has turned into for me.
That's fun, though, that you get to have that reunion at least once a year with those
nice,
guys.
Especially so. With people like Kevin and Andy and Marco are, for example, just scattered all over the country from here. So I don't get to see them all that often. So that was a lot of fun.
It's very cool. It almost feels like there's kind of a brotherhood of Star Trek writers, and the fact that you guys are all friends, that's really cool.
I don't know, we're all friends, but certainly we all kind of know each other, and a lot of us are friends, and not just a brotherhood, a sisterhood, too. Kirsten Beyer, and I think one of the things that binds us, obviously, is that we write Star Trek novels, but also we're Star Trek fans. So we start there with that base, and so we have a lot to talk about, and it's sort of interesting to be able to celebrate and commiserate and just understand what each of us have been through, because we go through the same process. So it's great. I have a great deal of respect for all of these people and a great deal of affection for them as well. So as I say, Comic-Con has become sort of just a reunion for me, and that's really nice.
Well, as you said, we are here to talk about Sacraments of Fire, which just came out. And this book, you in Revelations in Dust, we talked back when that book had come out, and you were kind of bringing in some elements, some ideas that felt like from some of the things that had happened all the way back in 2001 and all the way through what had happened in Soul Key in 2009, and then the Deep Space Nine story kind of stopped. And they've allowed you now to kind of go back and tell the story that they had been setting up with the Ascendance arc. Talk about, for you, the process of crafting this story when you are really, in some ways, having to stitch together the quilt that has become, the Star Trek, quote-unquote, book canon that we have these days.
Well, that's sort of an interesting way to put it, a compelling way to put it, I think, because there are a lot of patches in the patchwork. There are a lot of different pieces to try and weave together. Deep Space Nine, among all the Star Trek series, is the one that really, over time, and I'm talking about now on the television series, not just in the books, changed the most. You start with Dr. Bashir as this naive, wet behind the ears graduate out of Starfleet Academy who's looking for high adventure and really doesn't know what he's doing. Oh, nope, turns out he's a genetically engineered super genius. So, change was the hallmark of the show. And it did that from the very beginning up until the very end. I mean, at the last episode, we saw Odo leave the station. Sisko left the station for the Celestial Temple. We saw Worf become ambassador of the Klingon Empire. O'Brien went back to Earth. So all our characters are scattered to the wind. And when the books started to pick up the story, I think one of the things that the editors strived to do was to keep embodying that element of change that Deep Space Nine always had. And so we didn't just automatically bring all the characters back and make everything sort of status quo again, because there was no status quo in Deep Space Nine. We went with it. We invented new characters. We still visited with the old characters who had left the station. We certainly had some of the old characters on the station. We tried to continue the story in a way that, had the series not stopped on television, it might have gone on television. We wanted that element of change to keep being a big part of everything. But at the same time, there were lots of elements in the show that never really paid off. I mean, Bajor never joined the Federation in the television series.
True.
Sisko didn't come back from the Celestial Temple. Odo didn't come back from the Dominion. We didn't see if Odo was able to change the Dominion. All of these disparate elements. And so over time, as we added to the literary Deep Space Nine, we tried to, and certainly is not just me by any stretch, lots of other editors and writers who have done a great deal for the Deep Space Nine books. You know, they tried to follow up on some of those things and create new storylines that, again, moved forward. And so in some books, there would be new elements that would arise, new plots, but they wouldn't necessarily be paid off in that book. Certainly most of the books have stories that begin and end in the book, but there are still added elements that continue forward. And one of those, of course, was The Ascendants. And what was the question? I'm not even sure I'm answering the question now. I don't even remember what the question was. I've been talking so long.
You're starting off well. I think stitching together what we had with, you know, The Ascendant starting, and you know, we're kind of left in Soul Key.
Right.
And then, we've jumped so far now into the Deep Space Nine story, and things have changed radically, so putting that all together.
Right, and so, yeah, the Ascendants were one of these plots that the writers and editors had started to set up in the books, and it was just set up. There was an appearance in Rising Sun by S.D. Perry that had... the one lone ascendant appear and then interacted with Kai Opaka. And then we saw in the Soul Key that Ileana Gamor had been restored to her Cardassian self, still mad, insane, and leading, about to lead the Ascendants, apparently. But these were just sort of elements of the Ascendants. The plot had been set up, but there wasn't necessarily a particular plan going forward. We just knew that we were going to, this was a story we were going to take on. But then with the Typhon Pact books, we wanted to move Deep Space Nine. In order for Deep Space Nine to be a part of that, it needed to be, the storyline needed to be moved forward to be contemporary with Next Generation, essentially. And so we did that. We leaped the story ahead 4 years between the Soul Key and the next book, which was actually Zero Sum Game by David Mack, and then my book, Rough Piece of Empire, my Typhon Pact book, which actually takes place prior to Zero Sum Game, but it was the second book in the series. So that was, we leaped 4 years ahead, and I had a choice at that point, because my story took place with Sisko, and so there are a lot of Deep Space Nine elements in it. Do I just figure out what happened with the Ascendants and tell people what it was? That didn't seem very satisfying. I didn't think that would that was sort of honest or a good way to capture the imaginations of the readers. I could say that it was still going on, but that seemed unlikely to me. In the Soul Key, we see at the very end Ileana Gamor arriving to lead the Ascendants. It doesn't seem like it would take her 4 years to lead them to whatever was going to happen. So that didn't seem right. So instead, I chose to let it be known that whatever had happened with the Ascendants had been resolved, but I didn't let it be known exactly how. But I did give some hints about it. We saw an Ascendant with Kira, somebody at peace and somebody who apparently revered Kira, perhaps. So I gave some little hints. And I had an idea, if I was going to move the story forward, of where I might go with it. But it was no guarantee that I was going to be the one to do that. There are plenty of very good Star Trek writers, and any one of those could have been chosen to move the story forward. And then they would have had to try and figure out how to stitch the various pieces together. But it turned out to be me. So it helped me that I was the one to create some of those pieces. But I also, I had elements by, David Mack and S.D. Perry that I had to try and stitch together and hopefully come up with a compelling story for everybody.
Well, I really think that, it's kind of, I love how you had Kira kind of go back and become a part in those events, because it almost made it seem like that was kind of planned, almost like the story jumped forward specifically so the story could be told this way. And it feels kind of an interestingly organic way to do it, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. And yeah, I meant to do that, if only. You know, trying to figure out how to tell the story of the Ascendants in the past, I could have just set an entire story in the past. But, you know, we talked with my editor, Margaret Clark, and she was really pretty committed to continuing the story forward in the quote-unquote current time frame, which is roughly 2385, 2386. She wanted to keep moving the story forward there, and I agreed with her. And so, you know, I figured out this way to tell the story because I really, for a long time now, I've wanted to tell the Ascendants' story. And I had some elements in my head about what that might be if I was going to be the one to tell it, and other things I still had to figure out. But I took some elements from the Star Trek novels, going back well past the Soul Key and even back past Rising Sun, the elements from long ago, and tried to, you know, weave those together. I'm glad that it feels organic because that was obviously the goal, to make this feel like it was a natural way to tell the story.
With everything kind of coming together for you, I was kind of wondering, what did you decide and how did you decide, okay, how much do I tell in this book and then how much do I tell in the upcoming book, Ascendant? So you have very much duology here. Were you able to kind of figure out, okay, what do I need to put in this book and then what needs to come in the next one?
Well, that's an interesting question. And the way that happens is sort of organic. It happened with my previous two book series, which was Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn. It sort of became, when I started trying to figure out the Ascendant story, it sort of became clear that it was going to be something that was going to take more than 125,000 words or 130,000 words, and so it was probably going to be more than one book. At the same time, you want to tell a story that is complete in itself. Even if it has elements that are going to continue in future books, you still want to be able to tell a complete story. I mean, in Revelation and Dust, I set up a lot of stuff for Deep Space Nine going forward. I set up stuff for the entire Fall series. But I also wanted to tell a complete story, and I felt that I did with, and that's not the story that a lot of people expected. It was a story of Kira Nerys living a life in Bajor's past, but that was the story I chose to tell in that book. In Sacraments of Fire, there is a very strong story for the first officer of Deep Space Nine, Sandeska, a Bajoran, and he deals with some revelations about, possible revelations about the Bajoran religion. And that goes back to the sect that we've seen in the past, the Ahalavaru, which the Bajoran Ohalu, the Bajoran from the past, whose writings indicated that he thought the prophets were not gods, but simply advanced aliens, and that, you know, Kira was attainted because she posted the Ohalu text to the Bajoran Comnet and all of that. That whole story plays a significant role in Sacraments of Fire. And really, I guess because the Ascendants have been portrayed early on as very distinctly religious, I mean, religious extremists, it made sense to me to try and put together a story that dealt with faith, I guess, on and lack of faith on different levels. I mean, the Ascendants are religious zealots, but you wouldn't describe them as nice people. Right, but you don't want to say that all religious people are not nice people. So you've got. I try and look at all aspects of faith or a lack of faith. Maybe not all aspects, but different aspects of faith and a lack of faith in Sacraments of Fire.
Well, that brings us to kind of another point here. Is in this book you do present a lot of different faces of faith. For example, like you said, Sen, who's you know, faith seems to almost be shattered by what looks to be a pretty major discovery about his religion. And on kind of the other side, you've got Kira, whose experience with the prophets is, you know, does nothing more than strengthen her belief and make her more sure in her convictions. And I even look at a character like Tyranitar, who, you know, is kind of another character who's lost his belief, but has kind of gone in a different direction, kind of freed him to chart his own path and becoming really loyal to Kira in a way that's not forced like his loyalty to the founders, but kind of earned. What was your experience in writing about belief from so many differing perspectives?
Well, I made me think about a lot about that stuff a lot, because I did want to examine it from different angles. Tyranitar is really, to me, an interesting case. Actually, Kira is too. When you think about it, it's a little different talking about Tyranitar's faith, because his gods, I mean, when he believed in them, which was for the huge majority of his life, were demonstrably real. Mm-hmm. And you could even argue that they truly are his gods, since they really created his people. If they didn't create them out of nothing, they certainly genetically engineered them from existing beings or parts. I don't think that that's been exactly truly identified, but clearly the founders had a hand in creating the Jem'Hadar as we know them. So his gods are demonstrably real. Kira's gods are demonstrably real beings. So that's a little bit different than somebody believing in Christ or other gods and not actually having evidentiary experience of them, which makes it a bit different to talk about. How do you lose faith in a being that is demonstrably real? Well, you start to question their characteristics, their makeup, and really for Sandeska, the Bajoran who has a crisis of faith, it has to do with exactly that. I mean, he knows these beings exist, he reveres them, but then he starts to wonder if maybe, these are not gods, that they're just advanced beings, because there's certainly advanced beings out there in the galaxy. He believes in those. He knows that those exist. So, it was interesting, too, when you talk about Tyranitar and his faith in Kira, his loyalty to Kira that was earned and not forced the way the founders sort of forced him to be loyal. I think that's mostly right, but he's sort of wired, not sort of, he was wired to revere the founders as gods, to give absolute fealty to the founders. And when he discovered that they were not gods by their own admission, it shattered him, but he's still sort of wired to find something to believe in. And so, it ends up in Sacraments of Fire that he kind of unexpectedly, encounters Kira again and sort of, he gives his faith essentially to her. And part of that is because she has earned it. She may not be the fiercest warrior or any number of other things that he would maybe choose her to be, but she's demonstrated loyalty and courage and some other things that mean something to him. So that was for me just a great dynamic, the Kira and Tyranitar. I've always enjoyed the character of Tyranitar, and the danger of writing him, certainly initially, and even in the first, I don't know, however many books that he was in, is to start changing him, to start making him not a Jem'Hadar, but a human. And you don't really want to do that. You just want to make him grow, but grow as a Jem'Hadar. I have the same sort of attitude about Quark. I think Quark can grow and mature, but he can't become human. He's got to become a more mature Ferengi. It's maybe a subtle distinction, but I think it's an important distinction. And of course, having these different races with different characteristics allows us to shine a light on our own human foibles and failings.
Well, it was really interesting, especially this whole, the character of Sin and what they discover there on the Bajoran moon. it really did remind, you know, we had in Revelations and Dust your Archduke Ferdinand moment, that kind of historical piece that just really moved the story forward. For me, I really saw this kind of revelation for the Bajoran people is something that's like a Bajoran Copernican revolution, that, you know, the Church of Bajor is having to deal with. And, you know, I love the way the Kai is dealing with it, saying we have to tell the people this, you know, we can't, if I keep it under wraps, it's just going to be even worse. So it was just such an interesting thing to see, you know, how does faith deal with something that may or may not seem like it could shatter it from the outset?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a really interesting observation. I certainly didn't have the Copernican Revolution distinctly in mind, but I say that's a great observation. You know, I mean, certainly the crisis of faith is, we see it in Sandusky. We don't see the rest of the Bajoran society and how they're dealing with it, although we do know that they're sort of in crisis. You know, this is not something that's not going to have an impact. But the question is, what is it that, for a question for me to ask, that interests me is, what is it that will get somebody to lose faith? And lose faith is maybe the wrong term, too. Maybe it's not a question of losing faith so much as coming to understand that maybe you're not right. I mean, I think a problem in modern society here on Earth is that people choose to believe things regardless of facts to the contrary. You know, people get ensconced in believing not just religious things, but political things or just everyday personal things. And then if they get evidence to the contrary, they choose to ignore it, and they still believe what is not really true. You know, in science, if facts do not conform to the theory, then the theory must be disposed of. But sometimes in modern life, if facts don't conform to the theory, people get rid of the facts. And so, you know, I mean, that's perhaps a little bit of an obtuse way of looking at this Bajoran religious crisis, but that's something that I wanted to explore. And I also was not interested in saying these people are right, these people are wrong. There are plenty of people who believe there are very many religious people on Earth right now who are very good people, who help people. There are atheists on Earth who are good people and help people. You know, you don't have to be religious or not religious to still be, you know, a human being contributing to society. So, I don't know. I wanted to look at all of these things and try and, you know, I had to figure out a way to contextualize that in the Deep Space Nine universe.
Which is so nice. I mean, I think that's one of the strengths in Christopher Jones and I on The Orb. You know, that's our Deep Space Nine show here on the network. We talk about that a lot, you know, that, you know, Deep Space Nine was the first Star Trek to really kind of deal honestly with religious questions and not just downplay religion as it being something we need to correct, you know, but to say this is a valid form of life, you know, and we might not know the answers. And so that kind of mystery and ambiguity in that was so nice to see in a Star Trek show. And I think for me, as somebody who is a person of faith, it's one of the things that really led me to liking Deep Space Nine more than the other series, because it actually reflected my life in that universe for the first time in a way that didn't make me feel like an idiot, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I get that. You know, no matter what, I think it's always important, and Star Trek, I think, really epitomizes this, it's really important to treat everybody with kindness and respect. I mean, there's no reason not to.
Yeah, definitely.
And one of the great things about Star Trek, and for me, the most important thing about Star Trek, even when I was starting to watch it as a child, I had some sense of this, is that Star Trek represents an inclusiveness that I just find compelling and important and the best of all possible worlds. I mean, everybody deserves a seat at the table. You know, it doesn't matter if you're black or white or blue or green. It doesn't matter, you know, your religious beliefs, your lack of belief. None of that matters. Man, woman, other, it doesn't matter. You know, everybody deserves a chance. And I think that's really important. I think that's one of the reasons that Star Trek has endured, is that it has that message of positivity and that essentially goal for humanity is that, you know, we're all in this together. So I'm happy to see, you know, I'm happy that message is reflected in my writing, because it's chief among my positive aspects of Star Trek.
Well, that kind of reminds me of one of my favorite scenes in this novel, and that was actually when Deska is kind of having his crisis of faith, and it's really Ro who is kind of the one to talk him through it a little bit and console him and say, you know, if you need to talk, I'm here. And it was kind of just an interesting reversal almost, you know, kind of the person who is seen by a lot of people as being an unbeliever or faithless and kind of almost feeling sorry for her because of that, to have that kind of turned around and have her consoling Sen because his, you know, his beliefs have kind of been shattered, and not, you know, rubbing his face in it or something like that, but just saying, you know, I'm a friend and I know what it's like and I'm here for you. I thought that was just a great scene.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'm glad you liked it. That to me is an important scene. You know, Ro herself, you know, wearing her earring on the quote unquote wrong ear, you know, so that the Vedix and the Kai can't feel her paw through her ear. You know, she's kind of demonstrated that she's a non-believer. I think she's even said it outright. And I kind of soften her a little bit on this, because it also, Ro strikes me as the type of person who, you know, don't put labels on me. You know, that seems to me who Ro is. She wants to be who she is, and it doesn't matter what you call her. And, but, you know, I also feel that she's matured over the course of the books. I mean, she's
definitely
in command now, and, you know, clearly with that responsibility, she's got to, you know, consider all the people in her command. And I think that just gives her a more, perhaps, not more discerning outlook on everybody, but certainly a dedicated outlook. She wants, and these people are not just her colleagues, they're also her friends. Not, perhaps not all of them, but, you know, certainly her first officer, you can imagine having a close relationship. And you know what, even if they weren't friends, who wants to see somebody go through that? Mm-hmm. You know, even if you're a non-believer, you can understand how somebody losing their faith in their religious belief would be a terrible blow to them.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's almost like, it's a little bit different, but it's sort of analogous, where you can understand, even if you're not married, you can understand somebody who is married whose spouse cheats on them. You can understand that betrayal, even if you're not in a marriage yourself. And so I don't think Ro needed to be a believer in order to understand, in order to see the pain that Sen was experiencing. And of course, you know, she's going to offer a shoulder. That's who she is as a commanding officer. That's who she is as a friend.
I want to further that just a little bit and ask you about the character of Ro more specifically and how she has changed. I mean, she used to be a rebel without a cause, and then she became a rebel with a cause, and now, in this book, she has become the one with responsibility, you know, the one who is seeing that side of leadership in a way I don't think she'd ever thought she'd feel, maybe even understanding a Picard or an Akkar or any of those characters that she used to kind of buff up against all the time. And I thought that was really fascinating to watch a character turn like that. And it's been so organic.
I hope so. I want it to be organic. I'm not the only one who's written her, but, you know, I think we've all tried to make it that way, because, yeah, you wouldn't, at our first meeting with Ro or through the series or even in the first books, she's not the kind of person you would necessarily think of in command. Although I would suggest that she has a strong personality, that a leader really needs a strong personality. She has, confidence, also something very important. And she has a sense of right and wrong. Now, that's gotten her into trouble in the past, but it's still an important component of who she is, and it's something I think you need in order to lead people. And, you know, she betrayed Jean-Luc Picard and the crew of the Enterprise, and he forgave her because he understood, I think, that the reasons behind her doing what she was doing. And even though he disagreed with her, he also could see the value in her going to fight with the Maquis, going to defend them. So, and he forgave her. And that, I think that really is sort of a critical moment in Rose's life, certainly in her career, because it gives her
definitely
the confidence to, I mean, Picard actually, he forgave her, but he also on two different occasions encouraged her to keep moving forward, to stay on Deep Space Nine initially when she was in the Bajoran militia, and then ultimately when Bajor joined the Federation to make the decision to not leave the station a second time, don't leave the station, and this time join Starfleet. I mean, those were essentially her choices. She was going to stay on the station. She would have had to join Starfleet again. And, of course, she did run into some opposition from Akkar and others, but, you know, Picard was her champion. And him showing that confidence in her, that faith in her, if you will, I think really is that's just something that had an impact on her. And when you're thrust into a position of responsibility, and initially she was chief of security, but then first officer under Vaughn, when you're thrust into that role, I think if you're going to succeed at it, you have to take it on very seriously and dedicate yourself to it. And she's certainly done that. I don't think she's any less she has any less of a sense of right and wrong than she did. I think that under the right circumstances, she would disobey orders if that came up, because she's done that before. But I think she would, before she did that, I think she would take a more measured look at what it would mean for her to disobey those orders, because I think she's a more mature person. But she's not entirely a different person. Anyway, that's how I look at Ro. I really, I love the character Earl Laren. I really enjoy writing her.
Well, and there is that great piece of the book where she is talking to Prin, and Prin comes away with the thought of that Ro still might have had a plan in place to help, you know, Bashir that she didn't know about, you know, so there's still the question of just how much of a rebel is still left.
Right.
But she's also doing the right thing as a commanding officer with her, you know, subordinate of reprimanding her when she needs to be reprimanded and teaching her the lesson she needs to be taught. But at the same time, I think just she's being a good role model for somebody like Prin. So that was that's a nice thing. It's like you're still leaving the door open for those bits of Ro that, you know, might come out again if need be.
Yeah, she does. Ro absolutely does not simply reprimand Prin. She expands on what's happened and does leave the door open. I didn't write the scenes to which I referred where Prin sabotaged Defiant in order to help Bashir make his escape. Dave Mack did in his fall book, A Ceremony of Losses. But one thing Dave did in there was when Bashir was going to be escorted back to Deep Space Nine, he had Ro have Serena Douglas escort him back to the shuttlecraft, or to the runabout. I mean, that was Ro's order for Serena Douglas to do that. Serena Douglas is Bashir's soulmate. So
right. You
have to think, why is Ro doing this? Because, in fact, Serena and Julian then did collude to have him escape, and they made it look like he overpowered her, and, in fact, he does punch her, but, you know, with her completely willing to go along with it because Serena wants him to get away. But Ro is not stupid, and she's the one who put them in this situation. So you have to think, where is her heart at? You know, she's not defying orders, but she's making sure that Bashir gets away. Really, you could make that argument. And I kind of think that's where Roe's head was at, that she knew Bashir was trying to do something very important in saving the Andorian people, and she wanted to give him every opportunity to do it. That's how I read those scenes. So, Roe still is sort of, rebel with a cause. She's been a rebel with a cause, but she's now fitting herself into a command hierarchy, and she's a leader, and that changes her. But she's still, what made her a rebel initially, without a cause and then with a cause, is a sense of right and wrong, and that hasn't changed for her.
Yeah, definitely not.
One thing I noticed, kind of speaking about Roe and her, cause and that sort of thing, one thing that kind of comes up in this novel a lot is the idea of a life of purpose. Through Roe and characters like Sisko and Tyranitar, they both seem to be looking for and finding purpose in their lives. Specifically with Sisko, it's interesting to see how kind of new inspirations can come along in his life and reinvigorate a person. So I was wondering if you can tell us a bit about how you came to this place for Sisko, especially since he was such a force in the show, since you've been playing the long game with him since Rough Beasts of Empire.
Yeah, I think a sense of purpose, I think it's important in life, and it's certainly important in fiction. Your characters have to have motivations, consistent motivations, reasonable motivations, believable motivations, compelling motivations. And, when I wrote Rough Beasts of Empire, which was the second of the Typhon Pact books, although chronologically I think it's the first, in order to have Deep Space Nine be a part of that Typhon Pact series, we needed to bring Deep Space Nine forward, ultimately 4 years, in order to align it with Next Generation so that, we could be part of that story. So I was asked to do that, and I was asked also to get Sisko back into Starfleet and off of Bajor, because that's where he was. When he came back in Unity from the Celestial Temple, he didn't rejoin Starfleet. He just went back to Bajor. So I was given the task of getting him back into Starfleet, and I thought, well, how am I going to do that? And it just seemed very unsatisfying to just have him say, well, I want to go back to Starfleet now, and maybe try and return him to the station. This is stuff we've seen before. What is it that was going to compel him to go back to Deep Space Nine? I mean, yeah, he's got friends there, but what's he going to do? Is he going to displace Kira? By the time he comes back, she's been in command for 9 months, and at the end of the series of books, before Rough Beasts of Empire, which ended with the Soul Key, it's 2378, I guess. So Kira's been in command, or 2377, sorry. She's been in command for a year. So in order for Sisko to go back to command Deep Space Nine, Kira's got to be displaced. Doesn't seem like something that he would want to do to her, to have her demoted or have her become a captain somewhere else. So I don't know. I was just looking around for what was believable and dramatic, and I went back to the series to one of the many things that just never paid off, was never paid off in the series, and that was the prophets telling Sisko that if he spent the rest of his life with Cassidy, he would know nothing but sorrow. That never really paid off in the series. Not really. It didn't pay off in the series, and it didn't pay off in the books either. And so I used that to formulate the story that I came up with and gave Sisko a reason to go back to Starfleet. In this case, it was people would say abandoning his family, and where else does he know besides family? Starfleet. Of course, he wasn't abandoning his family. He was leaving them because he felt that if he stayed, they would die. To me, that's heroic. If I had a choice, if I stayed with my wife, she was going to die tomorrow, I would get the hell out of here. That's just what I would have no choice, even though it's not what I would want to do. I feel like it's what I would have to do. So Sisko did that. Now, okay, he's back in Starfleet. He can still be the emissary, right? But we saw that story played out over Deep Space Nine, the television series, and we saw it played out very well. And it's sort of, I don't say ground to a halt in the books. I mean, he was still looked upon as the emissary, but there weren't a lot of storylines that really had him and his mystical experiences with the prophets and all of that. And I thought, you know, maybe we've played this out. Maybe it's time for us to have Sisko have another part of his life, some other compulsion, or not a compulsion because that sounds like a negative thing, but, you know, something motivating him to do something else. And through the series of books, I sort of, for me, it was an organic process, found a desire for exploration that he never really had before. I mean, we didn't see it in the television series. From what we know of his backstory on the television series and then in the books, he was an engineer to start with. He only reluctantly became a command officer. He was an exec and then finally became a commander and a captain. That's not where he wanted to see his life go when he joined Starfleet. But he grew into it and clearly was a terrific commander. I mean, you could argue that he saved not just the Federation, but the Alpha Quadrant from the Dominion. And, you know, it's great, compelling character. But I found, like I said, organically, him moving away from that, moving away from the prophets and his life on Bajor. And because in the books, at least for me, as a writer, there have been a lot of political stories of late. I really had a desire, and I know some other writers and the editors too, who wanted to get back to that exploration part of Star Trek, you know, going out and seeking out the unknown. And because Vaughn, Elias Vaughn, was a character that had this, it was easy to see that that could rub off on Sisko. And also then his, you know, I gave him some experiences in the books where he did get to explore, and he found out, hey, this is something I'm gravitating toward. This is something that's fulfilling me. And, you know, when he rejoined with his family, too, now it's something that he can share with them as well. So I say for me, it's an organic it was an organic process for Sisko. He's sort of starting another leg of his life. And really, it's people do that all the time. I mean, Sisko himself did that, right? He had a wife and a young son when his wife died. Now, he was aboard a starship, but they were with him. He was living that life. His life changed when Jennifer died, and he reluctantly stayed on Deep Space Nine. And what sort of really led him do that was his affinity for the Bajoran people, despite some discomfort with his role as their emissary. He grew into that role as well. And, you know, so that's a really wholly different part of his life than was his life with Jake and Jennifer prior to that. Well, I'm saying that after 7 years on Deep Space Nine, he went to the Celestial Temple for 9 months, or at least 9 months from our side of things, and then back to Bajor, and now he's started on another chapter in his life, a different chapter, but one that, you know, hopefully will be compelling and full of great adventures that people want to read about.
Well, this book, I mean, it does have so many plots to it going on and lots of different things that we talked about. You're kind of...
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. I appreciate it.
Creating a whole, and was just wondering, you know, balancing all those plots and trying to figure them all out. And then, of course, you know, writing this new Deep Space Nine, you know, it's really not your fault, but, you know, you only have a few characters right now from the main series that are kind of left on the station at the moment. Talk about trying to work all that together and playing with the pieces that you have mm-hmm. left on the chessboard of Deep Space Nine.
Well, it's partly my fault, but not entirely my fault. we were left at the end of the television series with Sisko gone, Worf gone, Odo gone, O'Brien gone. So, Jadzia had died the year before. So, you know, a lot of these characters were just gone. Now, in the books, several have now also left. Bashir has gone. Ezri Dax has gone. But we have brought some characters back, too. I mean, initially in the very first so-called relaunch book. We brought back Roe Laren from Next Generation, and but in these most recent books, we've brought back O'Brien, we've brought back Nog. So, I mean, we are bringing some familiar faces back. And Kira and Sisko, even though they're not stationed on these planets, are still big parts of the storytelling. And, you know, we've created new characters as well. And it's, yeah, with so many storylines, it's hard to flesh out everybody. You can't get it, you know, I don't have a chance to completely flesh out everybody. But they're very distinct in my mind, and hopefully they're written distinctly so people can get some sort of feel for them. Some of these characters actually go back a ways. The science officer, John Candlewood, actually goes back to Twilight, which was maybe 2001 or 2002. So, I mean, we're talking about 12, 13 years he's been around. Now, he hasn't had any major storylines, so, I mean, that needs to happen so that we can get to know him. But some of these characters, I think, are starting to get fleshed out. The security chief on Deep Space Nine, Jefferson Blackmer, he's had some pretty significant storylines. So we're getting to know him. And hopefully, you know, we'll get to know everybody else. And hopefully they'll be compelling enough for the readers. I mean, when I wrote Twilight, which was the first of the Mission Gamma books, and one of the early Deep Space Nine relaunch works, it was Defiant out in the Gamma Quadrant, and I realized while I was writing the book that at some point I had Elias Vaughn trapped on this planet with Char, the Andorian, and Prin Tenmai, Vaughn's daughter. And there were, you know, huge tracks of this novel, or is the three of them trapped on this planet? And I realized, oh, great, I'm writing this novel, and there are no Star Trek characters, no television characters in these scenes. None whatsoever. This is a huge part of this novel. The main focus of this novel has no existing Star Trek characters, television characters. And I thought it was okay because I thought, you know, this is one way we're getting to know these characters. And hopefully they're compelling characters to the readers. So they're characters that the readers come to love. And I know that a lot of people came to love Elias Vaughn. I think there are a lot of people out there who love Prin Tenmai.
I love both of them.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, I mean, this is our job as writers, is to make these characters appealing or not appealing, depending on who they are. And you want to draw distinct personalities, and you know some of that comes out with relationships between people you know and them, like you know, Prin interacting with Ro. We know Ro, and in a lot of ways, Sacraments of Fire is a Sendeska novel, which you know I don't necessarily want to say because I feel like some people will go, "Who's Sendeska?" But he's been the first officer on the station for a while, and we really haven't gotten to know him all that well. We've seen bits and pieces of him here and there, and we do know that he's very religious and you know, trustworthy and competent and all of that. But I feel like we get to know him a lot better in Sacraments of Fire. So, you know, we're trying to get these characters out there and known to everybody and hopefully appealing to people.
Well, and at the same time, you know, I was realizing too in this book, we haven't spent a ton of time with the new Deep Space Nine. And so that's another character that we are getting to know. And for those, you know, we're all those fans and we like having the blueprints and everything we can look at. And we don't have that. So this is really an imagination of
you don't have
what
that.
This
have
place
that.
Looks like. You, yeah, you have it.
I actually, when I was, you're absolutely right. And I didn't really fully appreciate when I blew up Deep Space Nine how difficult it was going to be to create a new Deep Space Nine. I mean, sort of physically, I mean, I work with Doug Drexler and his team to you know, design the station. But I already started sort of designing it from the outside. But now I have to, these are all new areas. It's really interesting because when you write an original series novel or a Next Generation novel or Voyager novel or a Deep Space Nine from back in the day, you don't really have to describe the bridge or ops or quarks or whatever, because the readers are familiar with those sets. They've actually seen them. It's a whole different thing when you're writing an entirely new starbase, a huge starbase. And I actually draw the distinction very clearly. I don't think I've done it since the new Deep Space Nine has been around. I don't refer to it as the station anymore. I always refer to it as the starbase, because it's bigger and better. And it seems to me, if you're going to replace an old Cardassian ore processing station with something in an important area, you're going to replace it with state-of-the-art, you know, as impregnable as we can possibly be, starbase. And so I've wanted to do that. But yes, then all of a sudden now, okay, well, what the hell does the control center look like? What is the sick bay look like? What is, you know, all of these things? Well, what are we going to have on here? And so then I had to even start thinking about, okay, let's have some playing fields. Let's have a place where people fly. You know, we need to have a gigantic park. And let's, you know, where's the control center going to be? I actually had this notion that if you're going to have a control center for a starbase, it should be at the heart of the starbase, as far from danger as you could possibly have. You don't, you know, if you're going to build a starship that could go into battle, you're not going to put the bridge at the top of the saucer section where everybody can shoot at it. You're just not. And if you're going to create a starbase, you're not going to put the control center right out on top where everybody can see it. And so I initially called the control center the core, and I had it at the very heart of the main sphere of the new Deep Space Nine. Except, you know, I talked to Doug Drexler about this, and we had a big disagreement about this, a creative disagreement. And he ultimately convinced me that, no, it needs to be on top. It doesn't matter that maybe strategically this is not what you would do. This is who we are. We're the people who are out there,
right,
putting ourselves on the front line, not scared to engage with people we don't know. We need to be at. So, okay, now it's not the core, now it's the hub. And I put, you know, it's the intersection of the vertical rings. So, yes, anyway, I had to create this new Deep Space Nine, and it's still being created, but probably by not just me, but by other writers who, well, and certainly Una McCormack just wrote The Missing, so she had to, you know, have scenes on Deep Space Nine, and I know Dave Mack has in A Ceremony of Losses. So we're all putting it together and trying to flesh it out so that it will become that sort of background, all-pervasive character for the readers, just as the original station was.
I hope one day, you know, StarTrek.com or Star Trek Magazine will kind of give us a more in-depth look at the station, because I personally really love it. I think it's a great design. I love the homage to the original, but at the same time, like you said, you can just tell this is one badass space station. You know, like this is nothing to be trifled with. And so I love getting to hear more about it. But as all fans, I'm like, oh man, I want to see some blueprints.
You know, I didn't do this. We talked about blueprints a couple minutes ago, and I didn't do this, but I almost said to my editor, you know, how about we have a little fold out and we have, even if it's just the hub, you know, the new control center. Because one of the first things I did, knowing that I was going to have many scenes set in the hub, or at least some important scenes set in the hub, I needed to figure out what this looked like for myself,
right,
before,
yeah,
I could start describing it to other people. And at some point, I sat down in PowerPoint and created a blueprint for the core, the hub. And it was initially the core. And so I know, I know exactly where every station is, where every officer is. I know. So I actually, through the course of writing it, I know some of the officers who crew those stations during various shifts, because I've had things take place in alpha, beta, delta, gamma, delta shifts. So, you know, maybe that'll happen one day, because, you know, I have blueprints. And of course, I have some pretty cool drawings from Doug Drexler and Andy Probert, really pretty cool things on the way, you know, on the way to the starbase that we ultimately got, you know, graphically. But you never know. I mean, hopefully the Deep Space Nine books will do well. We've, you know, with Una McCormick's missing, we went back to the Deep Space Nine name on Star Trek novels, because prior to that, with Revelation Dust, it was the first book of the Fall series, and we put the Plagues of Night and Raise the Dawn were under the Typhon Pact banner, as was Rough Beasts of Empire. So it's been a long time since we had actually had the Star Trek Deep Space Nine title on novels. And they, you know, we did that with The Missing. We've done that with Sacraments of Fire. It's going to happen with Ascendance, which is out end of December. And hopefully they'll do well, and so we can keep writing. And I'm interested in the books getting continuing to get published, even if I don't write them, because I like reading them.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think Dan and I are both behind you, and that any time that they want to do the fold out, we're there.
Definitely. Yeah, the hub for sure is something that I would really, really like to see, because I mean, I kind of have an idea in my head of what it looks like from what I've read, but man, to see the actual layout of that would be really something special.
Well, I'll have to see. I have no idea what how cost prohibitive that might be or not. And I, like I said, I really did consider suggesting it, but I haven't yet. Maybe I will.
Well, I have to say too, as you said, we need people to continue to buy the stories, because it won't even matter if they're not buying the stories. So keep buying the Deep Space Nine stories so we can get that stuff. They'll want to do that stuff.
Oh, I can't argue with
that. So that would be great. Yeah. Well, of course, I would love to hear about what's coming up next for you. What are the things that people need to get from you? You know, any slight tidbits you want to tell us, you know, just kind of whet our appetite about what's coming in Ascendance that we, you know, might not get anywhere else?
I think Ascendance is in part going, in some sense, exactly where you think it's going, but not entirely. Ascendance, I will tell you this, it has a different format, different structure than Sacraments of Fire. And structure might not be something that readers are much interested in or even ever think about, but it's a different structure. And what else can I say about it that won't get me shot by my editor? I feel like it's a very much a Star Trek story, but it's also a little bit weird. I don't know. I really hope that people like it. You mentioned during the course of this conversation about this being a long, long game, which is something I tweeted out today. Somebody, a reader, asked me a question on Twitter, and one of the things I wrote back was that I've been playing a long game. And what I meant by that is that really we talked about earlier, which is that there have been a lot of pieces out there, and I tried to sew them all together into a quilt that everybody will like looking at. And some of these pieces are perhaps unexpected pieces. I mean, it's really easy to see that, you know, when Ileana Gamor showed up in front of the Ascendants at the end of the Soul Key and proclaimed, "I am the fire," it's pretty easy to figure that that's going to be a part of the Ascendants story. However, there are other pieces that I'm guessing are not obvious. I'm thinking, I'm hoping are not obvious, that are going to play into the story. It'll be interesting to see how people respond to it. I hope they like it. I certainly enjoyed writing it. It was fun trying to figure it out. It was arduous trying to figure it out. And then when it sort of came to me, it was very fulfilling. And I just hope I did the story justice. You know, here's something that's been interesting to me. In Revelation and Dust, I used an epigraph at the beginning of the novel. And what I did was I used a snatch of poetry I said was written by a Coromlan, the Bajoran who came forward in time out of the wormhole and proclaimed himself the emissary and Sisko stepped aside from him. This is in the TV mm-hmm. series.
Yes.
I wrote there in that epigraph that Coromlon had written this bit of poetry, and it came from his book, The Path to Ascendance, A-S-C-E-N-D-A-N-C-E. So ascendance and not A-S-C-E-N-D-A-N-T-S, not ascendance, the race. But still, I thought, this is so obvious. Everybody's going to know that I'm setting up, you know, I'm getting ready to pay off the ascendance story. When I put the path to ascendance, not one person wrote to me about that or have I seen anybody comment on that until recently when somebody asked about when the title of the next book, Ascendance, was made known. Somebody figured this must have to do with the ascendance. And I said, yeah, but I'm surprised nobody caught it from the epigraph on the previous book. And people are like, oh, yeah. And here I was thinking I was being too obvious.
That's awesome. That's great. I love that. It just shows you the things that even the most ardent of fans that will miss. I love that.
I thought it was, like I said, I was desperately concerned I was being way too obvious and plainly not obvious enough. Which actually works for me, because now, I don't know, maybe it'll be fun for some people. Well, seems like it's fun for you.
Yeah.
Well, making things, you know, enigmatic and kind of the hints you were giving for the next book are certainly enigmatic, so that's really exciting. I like mystery, and your description of it being weird actually makes me really excited for it.
Well, I feel like it's weird. Maybe it won't seem weird. I feel like it's a little weird and very Star Trek-y, but I'm not. Hopefully other people will think that as well. And when I say Star Trek-y, obviously I'm meaning that in a very positive way. I mean, I think, like, you know, Dave Mack's brilliant Destiny trilogy is very Star Trek-y in the sense that we didn't destroy our enemy, we freed our enemy. Mm-hmm. To me, that's the difference between, you know, just sort of a negative or brutal way of dealing with things and a positive, nurturing, constructive way of dealing with things, you know. I mean, go back to the original series, you know, Kirk may have wanted to kill some people sometimes, but then he didn't. And that's important. And, you know, it's a Star Trek ideal, I think. I don't know. I just think Ascendance is sort of Star Trek-y. I want it to be Star Trek-y. I wanted it to be. So hopefully it comes off that way. And I'll tell you this. I can tell you this about Ascendance. There's no 4-year time jump.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
It does largely pick up where we left off. So, you know, it's going where it's going. But it's, again, I think going also some places you might not expect.
Well, besides Ascendance coming out, what are the other things that you're working on or things that people kind of know about?
Well, I just actually signed a contract with Simon & Schuster to do more Star Trek work. So
right.
That's sort of in its nascent stages at the moment.
Excellent.
I have a couple of ideas that I have been working on. You know, I don't know if this is going to happen or not, but as with the television series Deep Space Nine, in the books, as much as we tell complete stories in a novel, there are always little things here and there that, you know, ongoing things. I mean, throughout the entire run of Deep Space Nine, as we've talked about, Bajor was headed toward joining the Federation, and then it never did. We continued that in the books. Well, in the books, there have been other things that have happened. There's Vic. Who's Vic Fontaine, who's sort of been missing in action since the destruction of the station. And Morn's been missing in action. So there are, you know, bits and pieces. Sandeska has had this terrible trauma. We've got the Bajoran false work. We've got all of these things that are happening that, you know, they're elements of that we're going to deal with moving. Hopefully, people are going to deal with moving forward, me or other writers. I mean, in the very first books that came out for the Deep Space Nine relaunch, Kira posted the Ohalu texts and was attainted, was essentially excommunicated from the Bajoran faith. And, you know, that was not something that resolved itself in one novel. It was something that played out over time to allow the characters and the writers to explore what this meant. And, you know, that's what we're looking at. You know, it's Star Trek, so we're looking at ideas and ideals and how society functions and how people function within it. It's what we do.
Well, where can everybody find you online and, you know, interact with you as well, especially if they want to? I've seen a lot of compliments so far about Sacrifice of Fire myself. So, yeah, tell everybody where they can find you.
Well, certainly I'm on Facebook. I have a Facebook page, DRGIII. And I'm on Twitter, David R. George, III. And I don't know if people use Elo very much. It's a new social media platform, but it has no advertising. I'm on there, DRGIII. And I'm probably going to be out with my own website fairly soon, but nothing to mention at the moment. But people can always find me online. There's also Simon & Schuster has a page where... I guess if you just go to Simon Schuster's website and search for David R. George III, you'll find that they have a page that it has all my works on there, but it also, I think there's a thing, I think it's called Authors Revealed, where Simon Schuster has asked me, and they do this for many of their writers, where they ask them some questions and the writer's answers are there. And also it has my face, it has links to my Facebook and my Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So I'm fairly easy to find online if you're dedicated to finding me.
Well, David, it is just been great to have you on the show. And I love getting to hear the background. You know, for me, Deep Space Nine being my favorite, it's always awesome to kind of hear the background information from the authors and what they were thinking when they were writing things, especially when you were talking about how you were deciding where to go with Sisko and all that. It's just fascinating stuff. So I appreciate so much that you continue to give us the time here on Literatrex. It really does mean a lot.
Well, I certainly appreciate the invitation and you allowing me to talk about it. You know, like you, I'm a fan, so and I'm a reader. Apart from writing these, I like to read them. And the characters and Star Trek in general are just important to me. And, you know, we all work very hard at this, and it's important to us that that, you know, we're carrying the torch forward, and hopefully people feel that we're doing that.
Well, the love definitely shows through, so thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today. Well, Matthew, I always love it when we get a chance to talk to the authors, and as you know, Deep Space Nine is one of my absolute favorite series, so it was definitely a thrill to be able to talk to David R. George about Acts of Sacrifice.
Man, it was great. David gave us so much background information on the thought process behind writing this, and, you know, there was so much material for him to cover. I don't envy him his position of, like we said, trying to stitch all of this together and make it work.
Definitely. It's a hefty book, and there was definitely a lot to talk about there. So, you know, we could have talked for hours more about this. I can't imagine how long it must have taken to write that book. You know, let alone talking about it. It's amazing the amount of just really interesting directions we could have gone in that discussion.
Well, it is amazing what these authors are able to do, and especially with what David was having to do here of take all these story threads that had been bypassed at this point and try and find a way to make it all work with what's happening now. And I think that I can't really judge this book until we get Ascendance, because I think they're going to be so much together. And I can't wait for Ascendance to come out and kind of see where we're going to go. And as David said, it's going to be weird.
Star Trek, it's going to be weird. I kind of like that.
Yeah. Well, isn't it Janeway who said weird is our business?
Right, yeah. It was, we're Starfleet officers, Mr. Kim. Weird is part of the job.
That's right. So, Well, weird isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM the past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things that have been happening around Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It wasn't so much, you know, some down and dirty action, you know, and stuff. It's more like Spock is in heaven and it's all good until he comes back, you know, that kind of stuff. I think that's pretty, though. I think those are the lyrics.
Earl Grey.
We divide the ship into one of two ways. Port goes to port. I better not see any starboard guys on the starboard phaser target practice. You guys know which side of the ship you're on.
The Orb.
Also, the original title of this episode was A Matter of Breeding, which when we talk about things feeling TNG-ish, that could have been a Riker episode.
The Ready Room.
It's about people and feelings and emotions. It's about philosophy. It's about the future. It's about hope. It's about glory. It's about intellectual promise. That's what Axanar is about. It is not a story about pew, pew, pew. I promise you that.
To the journey! I can just hear the Earl Grey people screaming, measure of a man, measure of a man.
And you know what I would say to that? Death wish, death wish.
Warp 5.
I remember watching Broken Bow when Enterprise first debuted when I was in high school. I remember revisiting it now in full, and I had forgotten the fact that Future Guy had actually played an integral role from the get-go with Silic and the Suliban, which we'll talk about later in the show.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I think part of it, you know, which is probably good, is that he's probably not familiar with what happened, you know, in season one of Next Gen, aside from hearing stories here and there. So he's just like, whatever, I'm just going to get the story.
The 602 Club.
I think he's very much recreating that THX feel, and you may disagree with it. You may not think it's, you know, it's great, but it's on purpose. He wants that world to be that way.
Let me just say, conceptually, I agree with that. In terms of execution, that's where I think he failed.
Literary Treks.
It's amazing to me, as I reread these stories, how much of it I just kind of think of as Deep Space Nine these days, even though it wasn't part of Deep Space Nine, you know, the actual series.
Axanar, the official podcast.
It is the spirit of TOS that matters that's being captured, but it doesn't necessarily have to be the aesthetic. The aesthetic was 1966 to 1969 that had its moment, it had its time, and there's a certain amount of charm still to that. But it doesn't allow you to push the narrative forward because that type of aesthetic holds creativity back, in my opinion.
Women at Warp.
My absolute favorite thing about this episode is that this is a love potion only if it's between a man and a woman. They make it explicitly clear that if you touch two men or two women, they just become really good friends.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Guys, check out these shows. Find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and, of course, beyond. And you know you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, in Apple, there's a few things you can do that really help us out, hitting the subscribe button or giving us star ratings and reviews. Those are some things that really help us move up in the iTunes rankings and make us more visible so more Star Trek fans can find out about the books and the comics that we talk about. And of course, if you are not an Apple user, you can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from the website and grab the RSS link there as well. And then I think the most important thing really is helping us out on Patreon. It does cost a lot for us to be able to bring all of this content to you each week, from Literary Treks all the way to the other shows that we do in the network, the hosting, everything that we do with the website, the programs that we use, all this stuff. It does cost us a lot. And so you can visit patreon.com/trekfm and you can help us and be part of our team. There are some goals that we'd like to reach and some milestone contribution levels that we've got for you that come with some great perks, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in the content development team. You could be a part of the Patreon roundtables that we've been doing, that Will Wynn has been heading up. We appreciate your support, guys. We know that you have plenty of things that you can support, and the fact that you would help us out means the world to us. So you'll find all the details again at patreon.com/trekfm. If you have any comments, you'd like to share what you thought about Sacraments of Fire, we'd love to hear from you at trek.fm/contact. You could leave us a voicemail. Look on the sidebar on the show page. Go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. Twitter at trekfm, a great place to interact with us. And of course, too, retweet the shows and retweet the stuff that we do. Help spread the word about our shows here. That really helps us out. I would encourage you to do that, especially at facebook.com/trekfm. That's a great way as well on your Facebook page to share the shows that we share there. Let other people know in your life, hey, you need to check out Literary Treks or The Orb or 602 Club, Standard Orbit, Commentary Trek Stars. I mean, all of these things that we bring to you each week. Of course, we've got the Babel Conference, and you know what that is. That's the listeners only discussion group. And I know that both Dan and I really love getting to talk to each one of you about the episodes each week and all the things that get mentioned in there. Just type Babel in the search field of Facebook, or you can go to the website trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar. And then the Goodreads group. Check us out on Goodreads. We've got the bookshelves with the previously covered books, as well as our currently reading section, so you know what's coming up in future shows, plus some great conversations going on about the books and the comics. Also love to thank our associate producers, Will Wynn and Ken Tripp. Without these guys, these shows could not be brought to you. I really appreciate their support through Patreon and bringing this show to you each week through that, and the fact that they've chosen Literary Treks as their place to support as associate producers. Now, Dan, when you're not parasail gliding with Prin over the wonderful new Nanbacko Park there in Deep Space Nine, where can we find you?
Well, Matthew, you can find me online. I'm at www.treklitreviews.com, and there I do reviews of Star Trek novels, both old and new. You can find me on Twitter at Treklit Reviews and on Facebook at facebook.com/treklitreviews. And also, of course, I'm kicking around the Babel Conference talking about Star Trek books and other topics. And you stole mine.
I love it.
I just thought of it too. Well, I was like, oh, that's a perfect.
I know how you like your Prin, so I figured you should get that joy.
It was like word for word coming out of your mouth. I was like, no. And Matthew, when you're not trying to figure out ways to cover your tracks about how you helped Julian Bashir escape custody, where can we find you?
Well, you know I'd help him escape. I mean, that guy and I, we're like brothers. Man, well, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can find me on Instagram at MRushing. You can also find me doing The Orb with Christopher Jones. We talk only about Deep Space Nine. So if you like Deep Space Nine and you enjoy the conversation we had today, you need to check that out. If you don't like Deep Space Nine, let Chris and I talk you into it there on The Orb. You can also find me on the 602 Club. We talk about all things geeky. Each week we pick a new topic and talk about that. And it's a great way to find out about some things you might not know about, find out some things you do know about but you haven't tried yet. We've talked about Star Wars recently. We're always talking about Star Wars somehow. We've talked about the new Terminator film. We've got some great things coming up like Ant-Man and getting into some of the Daniel Craig Bond soon. So we've got some amazing things coming each week for you on the 602 Club. And then there's my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.